All right. Good morning, everyone. Boker Tov. Welcome to Sunday Shul here at SPL. This is the course, The Chronicles of the Apostles. This is class number 79 in that course. We'll be in Acts 23 and make it into Acts chapter 24 this morning as we are following along the Acts of the Apostles kind of as our skeleton guide, at least for the first 100 weeks or so of this course. As I've already hinted at, once we finish Acts, that's not really the end of the Chronicles of the Apostles. We'll continue to look at other writings of the early church and other things that we can learn about this very early Jesus movement. But right now we are going to be picking it up in Acts 23. But let's get started with prayer. Baruch Ata Adonai Eloheinu Melech Olam, Asher Kidishanu B'Mitzvotav V'Sivanu Le'Asok B'Divrei Hadavar. Blessed Lord, since you have caused all holy scriptures to be written for our learning, grant that we would so hear them, read, mark, learn, and inwardly digest them, so that by patience and comfort of your holy word, we would embrace and ever hold fast the blessed hope of everlasting life. And we pray these things through Jesus Christ, your Son, our Lord, who lives and reigns with you in the Holy Spirit, one God, now and forever. Amen. So as we get started today, I think it's important for us to know that sometimes it's helpful to be reminded of the obvious, because sometimes it's so obvious that we forget about it. And today, what I mean by that is we need to remind ourselves that the people in the book of Acts were actually real people, that they really existed. And I don't just mean like Peter, Paul, James, and so forth. But I mean like these officials, these Roman officials. So we're going to be meeting a guy named Felix. Well, Felix was a real person and was a real politician in the Roman Empire. So we actually know other things about Felix outside of the Acts of the Apostles. Agrippa, we know things about Agrippa outside of the Acts of the Apostles. Festus, we know things about Festus outside of the Acts of the Apostles. As well as to remind ourselves where we've encountered some of these individuals, if we have, before, and then bring them back in. So it would be like if someone, you know, in our world, it's not uncommon, for instance, for even baseball players to appear before a congressional hearing, right? So when we have a congressional hearing, those are real senators and real congressmen and real congresswomen that are doing the questioning. And so what do we know about those actual people who are doing the questioning? And that can also help us better understand the storyline, better understand the context. It also will help you better relate, I think, to the book of Acts, because instead of just being kind of sterile black words on a white page and you're encountering a person named Felix, that sounds like a weird name, maybe the name of your cat or something like that, and you move past it, if you can actually visualize Felix as, you know, someone like, you know, Ted Kennedy or John McCain, or where you actually know this wasn't just a politician, but there's a whole story behind this individual. What is that story? And therefore, that might also help us understand some of the things they say and some of the things they do. And then what you're reading on the page, it hopefully becomes a little more alive, a little more relevant. So we're going to get familiar with some of these folks that Paul is going to be encountering in the book of Acts from this point forward. And as I said, just like politicians today, they have backstories, they have scandals, they have skeletons in their closet that affect the way they do business. It's not just the case now, but it was back then as well. So what I want to look at now is, and this is what I call Sitzim Leben, which is, what's the context? What's the cultural context? What's the political milieu going on for Paul as he's now been escorted out of Jerusalem and on his way towards the coast, towards the Mediterranean Sea, towards this place called Caesarea Maritime, or just Caesarea, this beautiful port city on the Mediterranean coast. As he's going there, what's the context? Well, when you read the Bible, when you read the New Testament, the Herods can be very confusing. And all of their relationships. And we've talked about Herod and his wives and his children and their wives several times in the Chronicles of the Apostles. This kind of helps you, but even when I diagram it like this, it still confuses the daylights out of me. Like this Herod family is just nuts. But so up here is Herod the Great. Herod the Great is the Herod of Luke chapter 1 and Luke chapter 2. This is the main evil Herod, right? That orders the babies to be slaughtered and so forth. So Herod the Great is the Herod of the baby Jesus time period. But he has descendants, including in one called Herod Antipas. He's also called the Tetrarch. And outside of Luke 1 and 2, outside of Matthew 2, whenever the Gospels talk about Herod, they don't mean Herod the Great, they mean this Herod, his son. And then there's another son, Philip, which is Caesarea Philippi, the other Caesarea is named after. And we've talked about Philip and his lifestyle a little bit. And then they had some descendants. You have Herod Agrippa the First, which in the book of Acts is referred to everywhere except Acts 4:27 and Acts 13:1. And then you have, of course, Herodias, who becomes Philip's wife, who was once Antipas's wife. We did talk about that, the brothers and their love of one woman. And then we come down to, so son, grandson, great-grandson, Herod Agrippa the Second. This is the Agrippa that will be coming up in Acts chapter 25 and 26. All right? And then there's Bernice and Drusilla, the sisters of Herod Agrippa the Second. All right? And Drusilla becomes the wife of Governor Felix, who we'll see very shortly in Acts 24. Okay? And so be aware that there's some brother-in-law kind of thing with Felix and Agrippa the Second. And we're going to talk about Agrippa and his sisters now so that you can get an understanding of them, get an understanding of that this is an individual who wants to be known as King of the Jews, who tries to sell himself to the Jewish people as their king. And then we're going to see some of the things in his life that you would begin to see why organizations and groups like the Zealots rose up, because he's anything but a king of the Jews, all right? But it will help set the context for it. It will also help us understand why Paul will eventually get passed back and forth and to and fro between these leaders and others. And so how it all gets started is the Roman Emperor Claudius appointed Felix to be governor over Judea around the year 52, to kind of be governor over the whole Judean region. And at the same time, he awarded King Agrippa II control over some of the territory that was previously held by his father, which is also in and around Judea. So Claudius appoints Felix and Agrippa II to kind of have territories in the land of Israel and to kind of be the Roman governors of these areas, the Roman representatives in these areas in Israel. Josephus said these words, Claudius removed Agrippa from ruling over Chalcis and gave him a greater kingdom. He gave him the Tetrarchy, which once belonged to Philip, which was Batania, Trachonitis, and Golatintis. He also added to it the kingdom of Licinius and the province of Abilene. And so Josephus tells us a little bit about how Claudius appointed Agrippa II some territories to become a tetrarch, a governor in Israel. In addition to this new kingdom, Agrippa II also had family business to oversee. His younger sisters, Drusilla and Mariamne, were still in Rome. They had completed their education, they were in their teens, and at the time this meant they were ready for marriage. So he brought them with him to the new capital of Caesarea Philippi. This is not the Caesarea that's on the Mediterranean Sea. This is the Caesarea that's in northern Galilee, up in the territory of Dan. It's called Caesarea Philippi, named after King Philip. Queen Bernice, who is now no longer queen, joined her siblings at the palace in Caesarea Philippi as well. The four children of King Agrippa discussed the future plans. The marriage of Mariamne presented no difficulty. Long before his death, King Agrippa had betrothed his daughter to marry Archelaus, the son of his military commander. And the wedding took place, went off without a hitch. Everything's great with that one. But Drusilla's situation was not so easily resolved. At the age of 3, her father had betrothed her to a Gentile named Epiphanius, who was the son of King Agrippa's friend Antiochus. The marriage was to take place only on the condition that the boy would undergo circumcision and convert and become Jewish, because the Herods, again, still had this whole idea that they're this Jewish royal family, even though they're Edomites and not Jewish, but they still wanted to present this whole idea that they were the Jewish royal family. And so this particular individual, if he wanted to marry Drusilla when they came of age, would have to be circumcised and convert to Judaism. Well, as it turns out, when he became of age, he decided having a blunt instrument put upon him was not the way he wanted to go in life. And so he declined the offer, and he declined the conversion to Judaism. This left Drusilla unspoken for. Her brother began to look for possible matches. The husband had to be royalty, and he had to be Jewish. King Agrippa's daughters were all famous beauties, but young Drusilla outshone the other two. Josephus even records, quote, "She exceeded all other women in beauty." The attention she drew drove Bernice, her sister, to envy and jealousy. And Bernice is probably as unstable as her great-grandfather, Herod the Great. Bernice resented sharing attention with her sister, so she mistreated Drusilla. So here you have a little, Snow White, Cinderella, one of those fairy tales, right? The beautiful sister being mistreated by the less attractive sister, both competing for a prince, for a husband, all right? And so Bernice mistreats Drusilla and encourages their brother to find a match for her as quickly as possible. Azizus, the Gentile king of a land known as Emesa, agreed he would convert. He fell in love with Drusilla, thought she was so beautiful, said, "I'll do anything to marry her." And so Agrippa said, "Anything? All right? How about you go see the doctor and we'll see." So he does. He undergoes circumcision and he converts to marry the girl. His kingdom was just north of Damascus, which is modern-day Syria. The teenage girl became Queen Drusilla of Emesa. Again, think modern-day Damascus, Syria. This left only Bernice unmarried. But if you recall from previous Chronicles of the Apostle classes, she's already been married twice, and she's already been widowed twice, right? You may remember Bernice. She's the black widow. She's the mother of two children. And Bernice actually doesn't want to find a husband because she's in love with her brother, Agrippa II. Yes, that's true, folks. All right. So why should she try to marry off to some other king when she has her brother? She enjoyed life at the palace in Caesarea Philippi, and she conducted herself as she was Agrippa's wife. In fact, they functioned as a husband and wife couple. Now, I don't know if you've ever seen a Russell Crowe movie called The Gladiator, but if you have, you will see that they take little bits and pieces of history from different Roman emperors and kind of combine them all into one. But they take this Agrippa-Bernice relationship and they have that being the case for the Roman emperor at the time that Russell Crowe has to be the gladiator. They have this really bizarre relationship. Some years later, ugly gossip, scandalous rumors began to circulate around the empire, and eventually everyone just recognized it was true and didn't want to lose their heads, so they just ignored it. So that's a little bit right now on Agrippa and his sisters, which is going to become important because remember, Drusilla now has been married off, but you notice I have wife of Governor Felix. But I didn't say she married Governor Felix. She married some other guy living up in North Syria, in Damascus area. So what's going on with Felix? What about Felix? These are some images of some coins from the time period that have both the image of Felix here. That's his name. The prefect Felix. And here is his wife, Drusilla. Okay? So how did it go from her being queen of some land in modern-day Syria to becoming the wife of Felix? Well, Felix, we need to know, was a very typical Roman, all right? So he viewed himself as sophisticated, intellectual, loves philosophy and art and fine wine, all those kinds of pretentious things. But he was also quite wicked and quite free in his lifestyle. And shortly after he took over as being the procreator of Judea, he had the privilege of welcoming King Azuzus and his wife, Queen Drusilla, to Judea when they came to attend one of the Jewish festivals. So remember, Drusilla's husband agreed to convert in order to marry her. And so they went to Judea for one of the Jewish festivals. Felix, being the Roman governor of Judea, goes out to welcome this royal couple to his land and shows them around. And of course, he falls in love with Drusilla and wants her for himself. So how does Felix go about stealing another man's wife, a queen? Well, he decides to use magic, like we all do, right? He decided to use magic. Now, technically, Roman law forbade magic. It forbade spell casting and sorcery, but many of the Roman aristocrats secretly engaged in the black arts, and Felix employed the services, and here's what's important. He employed the services of a sorcerer, a Jewish sorcerer, from Cyprus to assist him. And now, you're going to be surprised when you find out who this Jewish magician is, because you've already encountered him in the Chronicles of the Apostles. This is from Josephus, his Antiquities. When Felix was procreator of Judea, he saw this Drusilla and fell in love with her, for she did indeed exceed all other women in beauty. And he sent one of his friends to her, a Jewish Cypriot, someone from Cyprus, named Simon, who pretended to be a magician. He tried to persuade her to forsake her present husband and marry Felix. He promised that if she would not refuse him, Felix would make her a happy woman. Accordingly, she acted badly. And because she was eager to avoid her sister Bernice's jealousy, for she was very ill-treated by her on account of her beauty, was prevailed upon to transgress the laws of her forefathers and to marry Felix. Now, most versions of Josephus' Antiquities name the sorcerer as Simon. But there is another version of Josephus, just like we have different manuscripts for our New Testament. Same with Josephus. One of those manuscripts for the same text of Josephus names him not Simon, but Adamus. This name agrees with a version of Acts chapter 13, verse 8, where Luke tells us that the one from Cyprus named Bar-Jesus was also called Adamas. So think back when we were talking way back when about Paul encountering that guy who didn't like Paul encroaching on his territory, and his name was Bar-Jesus. Remember that? This is who Felix hires to go and convince Drusilla to marry him. So again, if you're watching a movie, way back 40 minutes ago when you were in the scene with Paul and the demonic girl that followed him around and all of that, and you saw that particular sorcerer who was in competition with Paul, he comes back into the movie now. All right, he comes back into the movie to help Felix get a wife named Drusilla, which probably means he also becomes Felix's kind of court magician, court advisor. And so when Paul appears before Felix, guess who's going to be sitting there, right? This guy that he's encountered before. So you begin to see how all of this is kind of neat and how it connects together. And so Felix pays the sorcerer to employ all of his skills, which in the end, he doesn't use any magic. He just used negotiating power, basically. But he convinces her by a combination of potions, coercions, and promises. She abandons King Azuzus. And Josephus, as he says up there, she acts badly, meaning she consented to engage in an affair with Felix. The matter goes public. Her marriage fails. She's no longer queen of Emesa. She's just Drusilla. Now she's to the custody of her older sister Bernice again. She shocked the Jewish world. Again, these are supposed to be the Jewish royal family. And now she's gone and married the uncircumcised Roman pagan Marcus Antonius Felix. Now the Jews already dislike Felix, but they reviled him when he supposedly married their princess, because now Felix could kind of hold this over the Jewish people. The scandal dealt a great blow to the pride of the nation, and no one could have imagined the daughter of Agrippa, the beautiful Hasmonean princess Drusilla, married to the reprehensible Felix. Again, Felix wasn't just Roman, but he was even the lowest kind of Roman. He was a freedman. The high priest Jonathan expressed displeasure about this affair with Drusilla. And from the last couple of weeks, what do we know happened to Jonathan, the high priest? Felix had him assassinated, right? He used the Zechariah and had him assassinated because he publicly opposed the marriage of Drusilla and Felix. So now you have another high priest that's going to be traveling to the court of Felix, who is only in that office because Felix assassinated his predecessor, right? And Paul is there and he sees Bar-Jesus, and kind of just some weird things will be going on. And so this is all that we have going on. Felix resents the high priest's meddling. He resents the Jewish presence. He can't stand their constant clamoring. So he really has no good use for the Jewish people. Okay? And so here he is about to hear a trial on a Jewish matter. Okay? So with all of that, let's look at the text now that we have some background of who the individuals that we're going to be encountering are. Acts chapter 23, verses 33 through 35. When they had come to Caesarea and delivered the letter to the governor, remember, Paul is escorted out of Jerusalem with hundreds of soldiers for his protection because they had learned about the assassination plot for Paul. The guards lessen up as they get closer to Caesarea by the sea. And the Roman tribune had written that letter describing how noble he was in rescuing the Roman citizen Paul, and just wanted to make sure everything got handled correctly. So they bring Paul, they bring the letter, they present it to Felix, they present Paul. On reading the letter, he asked what province he was from. And when he learned that he was from Cilicia, he said, "I will give you a hearing when your accusers arrive." And he commanded him to be guarded in Herod's praetorium. Now, if you go to Caesarea today, modern day Caesarea by the sea, you can still see the remains of Herod's palace by the sea. It's called Herod's palace. Herod never stayed there. Herod probably never even really saw the place. But Herod was big into building things and giving himself lots of credit. Who did stay there were the Roman governors for the region. So this is where Pontius Pilate lived, except when there was a Jewish festival like Passover, he would come to Jerusalem just for the duration of the festival to make sure everything was taken care of. But then he would go and live by the sea, by the Mediterranean Sea, in this palace. Because Paul is a Roman citizen, he technically is arrested, but his arrest, because he's Roman, is not being placed in a jail cell. Instead, he gets to live in the Herod's palace, just under watch. All right? And so when you go to this site, this is where Paul was imprisoned, in modern-day Caesarea. But again, don't think dungeon. Don't think chains bound and getting bread and water once a day. Instead, think fully clothed, fully bathed, access to hot springs, access to great entertainment at the Hippodrome, 200 yards away, access to the Colosseum about 700 yards away, access to walk around on the beach, just that guards were watching you and that you weren't going to be able to leave town. Kind of the bracelet on the ankle kind of arrest. So was he under custody? Yes. Was he in a dungeon? No. No, he wasn't. All right. He could receive visitors. He could write letters. He could talk to people. He could engage with the Roman soldiers and servants that were on duty. He basically had a really nice vacation. All right. And Paul isn't going to want to go anywhere because he's had this vision that, you know what, I really shouldn't have gone to Jerusalem like everybody and their brother told me not to for the last 3 years. It really did turn out horrible, and I really did create a whole mess for everybody in the Jesus movement. Instead, Jesus told me, now you're going to Rome. Well, for Paul, the easiest way to get to Rome is if the governor here will say, you need to be heard by Caesar himself. You need to go to the Supreme Court. You don't need to be in this district court or this circuit court. You need to go all the way to the Supreme Court. And then they would put him on a nice boat, and then they would, as a Roman citizen, kindly escort him to Rome. This is what Paul is now thinking is his mission and his purpose in life, is that he's going to get to Rome so that Caesar will want to hear his case, but by hearing his case, Paul will be able to proclaim Jesus in Rome. Okay? So Paul is there. He's in the Caesar's palace there, the praetorium. Felix would have brought his young wife to Caesarea. Again, this is Caesarea by the sea, not the one up north now. Again, the palace sits on a harbor. It was actually a man-made harbor, and it's one of the earliest times in history where concrete was able to be poured inside of water, right? So if you've ever seen, like, when they make bridges across lakes and all that, and you're like, how do they do that, right? Well, they first started learning how to do that right here at Caesarea Maritime, all right? They kind of made their own unique harbor. Drusilla would have been there as a little girl when her father was king of Judea and her mother was queen of Cyprus. Now she's back, and as the wife of Felix. The detachment from the tribune, Claudius Lysias, escorts Paul. Paul's seen this place many times. Caesarea Maritime, and again, if your Bible has a map in the back of it, when you look at it, that's really where the gospel leaves the land of Israel. You know, when you hear in the book of Acts at the beginning, go from Jerusalem to Judea to Samaria to the ends of the earth. It goes to the ends of the earth when it leaves the port at Caesarea. That is the port not only that Paul left many times whenever he would go on his missionary journeys or go on his travels. It's where all of the apostles left whenever they left the Holy Land. Whenever they left Israel from Caesarea. And so it's an important launching pad. You can also remember Caesarea in the book of Acts because that's where Simon Peter has his vision of the sheets and all of that. Remember, he's told to go to this house, Simon the Tanner's house and all of that. That's in Caesarea as well. So it's a major city outside of Jerusalem for the early Jesus movement. So Paul would be very familiar with it. Whenever he would have went to his home province, whenever he would have traveled back to Tarsus, this is where he would have left from. And so Felix agrees to hear Paul and says, just keep him in the praetorium. So then we finally make it to Acts 24. And after 5 days, of custodial vacation, the high priest Ananias, remember the high priest of Potrost, the one Paul claimed he didn't know was high priest, even though he's wearing high priest vestments, sitting in the high priest seat in the Sanhedrin where the high priest always sits. And Paul's like, oh, sorry, I wouldn't have insulted you like that if I'd have known you were a high priest, right? That same Ananias has now made it down with some of the elders and a spokesman, that is, an attorney, named Tertullius. Tertullus, we know about Tertullus. This is, again, the obvious. Tertullus just isn't a name in the book of Acts. He's a real hotshot attorney of the first century Roman world. This is a, what are some hotshot attorneys? You got Johnny Cochran. Who else? Who's been some hotshot attorneys that we know about? Gloria Steinem. Who else? What? Got to know some attorneys, right? What's that? Yeah, there you go. And we also have Giuliani, right? So
Judge Monroe.
Yeah. So Tertullus is one of these guys. In fact, he's notorious. That's what you need to know. He's a notorious Roman lawyer. Like, if you were a senator in Rome and you wanted to divorce your wife and you wanted to make sure, you know, it didn't interfere with you at all, this is the guy you called, right? He had had a billboard on I-65 driving down with some kind of cool name, you know, like we see the hammer, right? He would have had some kind of name like that, right? But it's important you know that, because what's the Jewish high priest going and getting like the Roman hotshot lawyer for, right? Okay? But he comes with Tertullus. And they laid before the governor their case against Paul. So Paul's trial, if you will, and that's kind of in quotes, because he hasn't really been arrested and he hasn't really been charged with anything. However, it all began by that whole altercation on the Temple Mount that we followed and just kind of wanting to get this thing settled. And so it begins 5 days later when what we will call, for lack of better terms, the prosecution arrives. Luke would have been there. He would have had access to the trial records. And he's included for us some kind of shorthand version here. Luke writes in Remez. He doesn't write everything. He doesn't record everything for us. He just lets us know what he thinks he needs to let us know. The reference to Paul's friends in Acts 24, verse 23, indicate that Paul's disciples and other believers had also arrived. And again, the prosecution team was the high priest Ananias, other people probably from the Sanhedrin, Sadducees no doubt, handpicked for their loyalty, and this professional Roman attorney named Tertullus. Again, why would the high priest take this time and effort to travel all the way to Caesarea with a hotshot Roman attorney, all for one disciple of Jesus? Ananias assumed the prestige of his weighty presence would influence the verdict. He'd also taken a personal interest in seeing the matter through to the end. Tertullius is short for Tertullianus. Again, a high-powered Roman lawyer, he was the best that money could buy in the Caesarea area. He was not a Jew, but he was the best that they could get for their case. Except for Drusilla, Felix has no use for Jews. He's anti-Semitic, even though he fell in love and married a Jew. The theologian Witherington identifies the type of trial as the extraordinum, which is a type of trial that existed in Roman law. Kind of like how we have small claims court, we have civil court, we have criminal court, we have appeals court. You know, we have different kinds of courts. And within those courts, while they all operate very similarly, they also have within them a different set of rules, a different set of protocols, a different set of procedures, and so forth. Well, this seems to be the model of what's known as the extraordinum. And this is Witherington's quote. And this is a lengthy quote, but it's his quote, so quotation marks. The case was heard by the governor in person while seated on the tribunal, assisted by his advisory council and a scribe and notaries who would write up the minutes of the proceedings. The trial was open to the public and followed the accusatorial, not inquisitional, method of proceeding. This involved the defendant being confronted by his accusers face to face, after which he would make an apology or defense. The burden of proof lay on the accuser in these trials. The judge had the flexibility in establishing what the crime of any was, or what the real bone of contention was, and the judge had the flexibility to determine the punishment. He could reach an immediate decision. He could end the trial quickly. He could also postpone rendering a verdict and lengthen the litigation period. The governor could postpone matters, in fact, indefinitely. All right. So that's the type of trial that seems to be going on here. So basically, Felix is going to hear one side accuse the other face to face. And then Felix decides, do I want to continue? Do I care about this at all? Because if the judge decides, I don't even care about this, he can be done with it. He can call for more witnesses. He can call for more time. He can call to hear from the other side. It's really up to the judge to decide what the next step is after the face-to-face accusation. So the text continues, verses 2 through 6, Acts 24. And when he had been summoned, Tertullus began to accuse him. This is Paul. So when Paul had been summoned, Tertullus, the attorney, comes up and says, since through you we enjoy... This is him speaking to Felix. Since through you we enjoy much peace, and since by your foresight, most excellent Felix, reforms are being made for this nation. So he begins with flattery, right? So he begins by flattering Felix. Oh, you're awesome, Felix. The things you've done for this area, the reforms, the laws you've passed, it's been amazing. You're just the best guy ever, right? In every way and everywhere, we accept this with all gratitude, right? So flattery. But to detain you no further, I beg you in your kindness to hear us briefly, right? Thank you for hearing us. You're awesome. You're wonderful. And in fact, I'm really embarrassed to have to even talk about this before you because it's so stupid and someone as smart as you is clearly going to see what a buffoon this guy Paul is. And you're just clearly going to go ahead and just be done with him. So let me just quickly tell you what you need to know so that in all your smartness, you can handle him. For we have found this man a plague, one who stirs up riots among all the Jews throughout the world, and is a ringleader of the sect of the Nazarenes. He even tried to profane the temple, but we seized him, Okay? So focusing on a couple of main points there that would have been sensitive to the Roman ear. Stirring up Jews, because that tends to be riots, and that tends to involve calling in the cavalry, and that tends to involve thousands, if not tens of thousands, of dead people. And they don't like doing that at all, because that's just not a good thing to do. It's not a good way to conduct business. It's not a way to keep the city running, and it's not a good way for the Jewish people to be slaves without knowing they're slaves, right? The best way to keep them slaves is let them have jobs, let them have a temple, let them have a priesthood, let them think they're in their own land, let them think they're being themselves, but they're paying taxes to us. That's really what Rome wants. So they don't want Jews getting a spirit of nationalism. They don't want Jews being stirred up to revolt. And then the accusation to desecrate the temple. Same kind of thing. Even in modern day, in our world today, right? In Israel, if you want to get people stirred up on either side, right? This isn't picking a side. This is either side can do it to the other side at the drop of a hat. One side accused the other side of doing something on the Temple Mount. You do that and you have random acts of violence and just horrible, you have a horrible 2 or 3 months. If one side just says, that side's doing that on the Temple Mount, right? That side's digging up the foundation so that it'll collapse into the ground. It could be something so nonsensical that there's no way anybody will believe it. But all you got to do is hurl the accusation, and it causes absolute, utter chaos, right? And not only is it true now, it was true then, all right? And so trying to portray Paul as this horrible, horrible rebel rouser that's dangerous for the Roman Empire. So Tertullius, as I said, as we could read, begins his formal address, again, with flattery and all of that. That's kind of also protocol for the way you would do in a Roman court of law. It's not a whole lot different, but much abbreviated, even in our courts of law. You might begin your case with, Your Honor, right? That's a form of flattery. Your Honor, if I might address the court and things like that. We know the kinds of games we could even hear with flattery and so forth. But as we've already hinted at, Felix was not most noble, and he was not excellent. He terrorized his subjects, but it was part of the protocol. Rather than accusing Paul on religious grounds, this is not a religious trial. So there's nothing being brought up about Jesus. There's nothing being brought up about Messiah. There's nothing being brought up about inclusion of Gentiles. There's nothing being brought up about the gospel, right? Nothing. There's no theological issues or religious grounds. Tertullius accuses him solely on civil and political crimes. He's portraying Paul as a dangerous revolutionary, instigator of riots, causer of civil unrest, the ringleader of a dangerous Jewish sect. Caiaphas and Annas, of the time when Jesus went to the trial before the Sanhedrin, used a similar strategy when they brought Jesus before Pilate. Remember when they brought Jesus before Pilate, they were like, this man tells us he's king, and we have no king but Caesar, right? By depicting Paul as this ringleader, they hope to see Paul eventually crucified as a zealot. So these are the three main charges that are being brought up. Paul stirs up riots among Jews everywhere. Bad for the Roman Empire. Paul is the ringleader of the sect of Jews known as the Nazarenes. So again, trying to portray him as like a leader of a zealot kind of movement. Paul attempted to desecrate the temple, which again is a hot button thing. Serious charges, and could result in Rome deciding to execute Paul. The charge of attempting to desecrate the temple was baseless. It could not be proven. It stemmed from the original allegation of bringing Gentiles to the Temple Mount. But the other two charges did have substance. Because, let's be honest, we've been following Paul around for about 50 weeks now, and dissension and civil unrest does seem to follow Paul everywhere he goes, does it not? And he is indeed one of the leaders of the sect known as the Nazarenes. So two of these charges Paul needs to take seriously, because two of these charges could result in his death. Now I want to talk about the accusation that he's the ringleader of the Nazarenes. It's important to note that in the first century, at the time the book of Acts is written, at the time the Gospels were written, at the time the New Testament was written, many in the land of Israel referred to the disciples of Jesus as the sect of the Nazarenes, which in Hebrew is pronounced Netzarim or Notzrim, depending on how you want to do your accent. Netzarim or Notzrim. This is actually still very common for Jewish sects today. It is very common for Jewish sects today, you know, groups that kind of break off from just your ordinary, everyday, mainstream, run-of-the-mill, I'm Jewish, but have a distinct identity, usually a distinct messianic identity, to be known within Judaism by the geographic location of their Rebbe, the geographic location of their chief rabbi or their founder. So, for instance, in New York City, there are a large group of black suit, white shirt, black hat, long curl wearing Jewish people that are known as Lubavitch, after a place in Russia, because their original Rebbe, their founder, was from this place in Russia. So they're called the Lubavitchers. All right? There's also the Breslovers, who follow Rebbe Nachman of Breslov. Breslov is a town in modern-day Ukraine. So they're called the Breslov Hasidim. And you got the Lubavitcher Hasidim. You also have the Slonimers. You have the Bostoners. You have many more that go by these distinct names. What usually marks them, though, is that they are incredibly pious, passionate, spirit-filled, who believe their founder, if he wasn't the Messiah — most believe he was — if he wasn't the Messiah, it's his teachings that will bring the Messiah, and so they're very messianic. So, for instance, the Breslovers. One of my good friends, teachers, is a Breslover. All right? In Israel today, Breslovers are called by other Jews not just Breslovers, but dead messianics. And the reason they call them dead messianics is because they follow a dead guy that they claim is the Messiah, Rabbi Nachman of Breslov. All right? And so you can kind of see why the early followers of Jesus in the land of Israel were called Nazarenes, Notzrim, Netzarim, because the founder, the chief rabbi, the one who instigated all their messianic fervor and passion and their what makes them different in their worship and makes them different in the way they react to the rest of the world, is the one that came from Nazareth. So the terminology, the sect of the Nazarenes, indicates that Ananias and the men of the Sanhedrin considered the disciples not to be a different religion. That's important. They did not view them as Christians, the way we hear the word Christian. They viewed them as a sect of Judaism. It's a sect they disagreed with, but they viewed them as a sect of Judaism, a denomination of Judaism. And so even today, like with the Breslovers or the Lubavitchers, it's not uncommon for those outside of those circles to make fun of them. Like Breslovers, they're kind of like the hippies of Judaism. Like, you know, hey, what's the use of showering? You're only going to get dirty again, kind of thing. Why comb my hair? It's only going to get messy. And they like to run around and dance, and they like to play loud music, and they'll stop a van in the middle of traffic in Israel block traffic and then blast music and dance around their bus proclaiming the teachings of Rabbi Nachman and throw his books out to people, right? And so people obviously get angry at that, get mad about that, make fun of them for that. But at the end of the day, no one, including other Jews, deny they're Jews, right? They disagree vehemently with some of their teachings or some of their ways, but they never deny they're Jews, all right? And so at this point in the game, the same is true for Jesus' followers. They're still viewed, as the book of Acts calls them, this sect. And that's a very specific word being used there in the Greek. It's a denomination in Judaism. The term Nazarenes, again, comes from the word Nazareth. And so Jesus' followers early on were called Notzrim or Netzarim. And in case you have in your mind, oh, doesn't it say somewhere in Acts and that they were first called Christians in Antioch? Well, guess what language they spoke in Antioch? Hebrew and Aramaic. These Jewish people, right? Well, what's the word for Christian in Hebrew? Technically, it would be Notzrim if you were speaking modern Hebrew. But it's Messianic. They were called Messianics in Antioch. They were first called Messianics. Not Christian in the way you think Christian church. That did not exist. Two things that did not exist in the early church. The New Testament church. No New Testament and no church. Right? So these terms meant different things back then than they do now. Right? So culturally, Sitzim Laban, they are viewed as a sect within Judaism. So in modern day Hebrew, again, Christians are called Notri. In Arabic, a cousin language, they're called Nasrin. But you can hear Nasrim, Nasrim in the Arabic. So in Arabic, Christians today are still called Nazarenes. In Hebrew, they're still called Nazarenes. In fact, most Aramaic-derived languages still have it, whether it's Persian, Armenian, Syriac, and the different dialects of Arabic, all have Christian as Nazarene. Jewish believers continued to identify themselves as Nazarenes up until the 5th century. In fact, the church father Jerome knew Nazarene Jews, and he wrote about them, and he borrowed books from them. Epiphanius, a church historian, when he wrote about the Nazarene Jews, said, "They are no different than any other Jew you will meet, other than they believe Jesus is their Messiah." Okay? So that's a little what's meaning by he's this ringleader of this sect. Verses 7 and 9. But Lysias, the commander, came along, that's the tribune, and with much violence took him out of our hands, ordering his accusers to come before you. And by examining him yourself concerning all these matters, you will be able to ascertain the things of which we accuse him. And the Jews also joined in the attack, asserting that these things were so. So the attorney kind of finishes his argument. He levels out the three charges. In the real trial, he would have unpacked all of those. Luke doesn't think you need to hear that. Luke just thinks you need to know what the three points were. And then you hear his concluding remarks that there's much violence, we're bringing him to you, and then other people brought forth their complaints. Tertullus claimed that the Sanhedrin had arrested Paul for many crimes, but that was not true, and we know that's not true. He was also blamed. He also blamed the tribune Lysias for interfering in the judicial process. He explained that the Sanhedrin intended to judge Paul according to the Torah when the Roman tribune came on the scene and took him out of their hands, and that's what caused all the violence. But of course, we know better because we've been reading the story. Tertullus argued that it was not, if it was not for the unnecessary meddling of the tribune, this would already be resolved. Tertullus rested his case by turning the proceedings over to Felix, which then leaves it in Felix's hands. And Felix can then make the decision what will happen next. And the Jews that are in this text in verse 9, this would be referring to Ananias and the colleagues from the Sanhedrin who would have added their testimony to the attorney's words. And so with that, the prosecution, Ananias, Tertullus, handed over to Felix. And when we come back together and get back into the book of Acts, we'll find out what Felix does with the information. Will he make an immediate ruling? Will he delay the read? Will he want more information? Will he want to hear from Paul? What will Paul say? And what will Felix's final decision be in this matter? All right. So that's where we'll pick it up when we get back into class. Next week, we will have class, so hear that well. There will be class in here next week. I will not be here, but there will be class, and you'll be watching at least 45 minutes to an hour of a documentary on Paul that I've spoken about before that I think is worth your watching. I'm once again making the disclaimer that is recorded. Do not agree with everything in this documentary. In fact, I vehemently disagree with the very opening sentence. All right? So from the get-go, I would already have to pause it and say, well, hold on a second. All right? But having said that, there's a lot of good stuff in there. And I think the good outweighs the bad. I also think you're smart enough. You're adults. You're thinkers. You've been in the Bible with me for 2.5 years, some of you. You can think through some of this yourself and figure out, yeah, that's trash, right? You'll know what's trash and what's not trash, all right? I trust you. The worst thing I could do is be so afraid you might hear something and believe it that I don't expose you to good stuff, all right? I do not endorse the documentary. I just think it's worth you watching, all right? And it deals primarily with Paul in his relationship with the disciples in Jerusalem. And was that relationship ever a good relationship? And how did that relationship end at the end of the book of Acts? The whole contribution, all of those things we've talked about, the documentary deals with that. And it has some really good scholars. Some of them are friends of mine. They've been members of different societies that I've gone to meetings of, that I know, that I have email dialogues with, that I highly recommend. And then it's got some flat-out crazy guys, right, that just don't know what they're talking about, okay? All that's recorded, so I have the disclaimer. Don't believe everything you see. But think about it. It's a good documentary, right? And it's kind of done in-house, so it kind of looks that way. I mean, it's really a scholar who really had this idea and wanted to get it out, and no one would buy it, literally. So he just made it himself, all right? So only those kind of on his inner circle kind of know about it. And so it kind of has that feel, but that's okay. The content's what's good. So just pay attention to it and enjoy it and take from it what you can, okay? But Acts wasn't written in the 90s. I'll just tell you that. That's how it opens. No. It was written before the temple was destroyed. But that's okay, right? You don't have to agree with everything someone says in order for them not to have valid points. All right, let's close with a blessing. Baruch atah Adonai notein hadavar. Blessed are you, Lord God, who has given to us the gift of the Holy Scriptures. Amen.